would be apportioned by population, and the Senate would have equal votes for each state. Samuel Johnson, also of that state, explained the thinking behind what would become known as the Connecticut Compromise. The new country was, in some ways, one political society. But in other ways, it was a federation of separate states. Yet these two concepts need not conflict, for they could be combined as halves of a unique whole. There was, however, little discussion of the plan. By a 6-5 vote, the idea was rejected for the time being, in favor of proportional representation in both chambers. As the days grew even hotter, so again did the dispute over representation. William Patterson of New Jersey proposed a counterplan, based on amending the articles rather than supplanting them, that featured a single house legislature in which each state, large or small, would have one vote. The larger states were able to defeat that idea, but the debate grew so intense that one Delaware delegate suggested that if the large states sought to impose a national government, the small ones will find some foreign ally of more honor and good faith who will take them by the hand and do them justice. Once again, it was time for Franklin to try to restore equanimity. And this time, he did so in an unexpected way. In a speech on June 28th, he suggested that they open each session with a prayer. With the convention groping, as it were, in the dark to find political truth, he said, how has it happened that we have not hitherto once thought of humbly applying to the Father of Lights to illuminate our understandings? Then he added in a passage destined to become famous, the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men. And if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? Franklin was a believer, even more so as he grew older, in a rather general and at times nebulous divine providence, the principle that God had a benevolent interest in the affairs of men. But he never showed much faith in the more specific notion of special providence, which held that God would intervene directly based on personal prayer. So the question arises, did he make his proposal for prayer out of a deep religious faith, or out of a pragmatic political belief that it would encourage calm in the deliberations? There was, as usual, probably an element of both, but perhaps a bit more of the latter. Franklin was never known to pray publicly himself, and he rarely attended church. Yet he thought it useful to remind this assembly of demigods that they were in the presence of a God far greater, and that history was watching as well. To succeed, they had to be awed by the magnitude of their task and be humbled, not assertive. Otherwise, he concluded, we shall be divided by our little partial local interests, our projects will be confounded, and we ourselves shall become a reproach and a byword down to future ages. Hamilton warned that the sudden hiring of a chaplain might frighten the public into thinking that embarrassments and dissensions within the convention had suggested this measure. Franklin replied that a sense of alarm outside the hall might help rather than hurt the deliberations within. Another objection was raised, that there was no money to pay a chaplain. The idea was quietly shelved. On the bottom of his copy of his speech, Franklin appended a note of marvel. The convention, except 3 or 4 persons, thought prayers unnecessary. The time had come for Franklin to propose more earthly measures. 2 days after his prayer speech, on Saturday, June 30th, he helped to set in motion the process that would break the impasse and to a large extent shape the new nation. Others had discussed compromises, and now it was time to insist on one and to propose it. First, Franklin succinctly stated the problem. The diversity of opinions turns on 2 points. If a proportional representation takes place, the small states contend that their liberties will be in danger. If an equality of votes is to be put in its place, the large states say their money will be in danger. Then he gently emphasized in a homespun analogy that drew on his affection for craftsmen and construction the importance of compromise. When a broad table is to be made and the edges of planks do not fit, the artist takes a little from both and makes a good joint. In like manner here, both sides must part with some of their demands. Finally, he incorporated a workable compromise into a specific motion. Representatives to the lower house would be popularly elected and apportioned by population. But in the Senate, the legislatures of the several states shall choose and send an equal number of delegates. The House would have primary authority over taxes and spending, the Senate over the confirmation of executive officers and matters of state sovereignty. The convention proceeded to appoint a committee, which included Franklin, to draw up the details of this compromise, and by a close vote it was finally adopted, in much the form Franklin had proposed, on July 16th. "This was Franklin's great victory in the convention," declares Van Dorn, "that he was the author of the compromise which held the delegates together." That, perhaps, gives him a bit too much credit. He was not the author of the idea, nor the first to suggest it. It grew from proposals by Sherman of Connecticut and others. Franklin's role, nonetheless, was crucial. He embodied the spirit and issued the call for compromise. He selected the most palatable option available and refined it. And he wrote the motion and picked the right moment to offer it. His prestige, his neutrality, and his eminence made it easier for all to swallow. The artisan had taken a little from all sides and made a joint good enough to hold together a nation for centuries. A few days after he offered his compromise, Franklin hosted some of the delegates for tea in his garden, including Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts, a leading skeptic of unfettered democracy. But Franklin's shaded garden was a place where controversies could be cooled. Gerry invited along a Massachusetts minister named Manasseh Cutler, a portly and congenial character who was in town pushing the territorial schemes of the Ohio Company, which he had helped found. In his journal, Cutler noted that, "My knees smote together at the prospect of meeting the celebrated sage." But he was immediately put at ease by Franklin's unassuming style. "I was highly delighted with the extensive knowledge he appeared to have of every subject, the brightness of his memory, and clearness and vivacity of all his mental faculties, notwithstanding his age," Cutler recorded. "His manners are perfectly easy, and everything about him seems to diffuse an unrestrained freedom and happiness. He has an incessant vein of humor, accompanied with an uncommon vivacity, which seems as natural and involuntary as his breathing. Discovering that Cutler was an avid botanist, Franklin produced a curiosity he had just received. A 10-inch snake with 2 perfectly formed heads preserved in a vial. Imagine what would happen, Franklin speculated with amusement, if one head of the snake attempted to go to the left of a twig, and the other head went to the right, and they could not agree. He was about to compare this to an issue that had just been debated at the convention, but some of the other delegates stopped him. "He seemed to forget that everything in the convention was to be kept a profound secret," Cutler noted. But the secrecy of convention matters was suggested to him, which stopped him, and deprived me of the story he was going to tell. The point Franklin was about to make, no doubt, was the same one he had made in the Pennsylvania State Convention in 1776, when he argued against a 2-chamber legislature because it might fall prey to the fate of the fabled 2-headed snake that died of thirst when its heads could not agree on which way to pass a twig. Indeed, in a paper he wrote in 1789 extolling Pennsylvania's unicameral legislature, he again referred to what he called the famous political fable of the snake with 2 heads. He had come to accept, however, that in forging the compromise needed to create a national Congress, 2 heads could be better than 1. On other issues as well, Franklin was usually on the side favoring fewer fetters on direct democracy. He opposed, for example, giving the president a veto over acts of Congress, which he saw as the repository of the people's will. Colonial governors, he reminded the delegates, had used that power to extort more influence and money whenever the legislature wanted a measure approved. When Hamilton favored making the president a near monarch to be chosen for life, Franklin noted that he provided living proof that a person's life sometimes lasted longer than his mental and physical prime. Instead, it would be more democratic to relegate the president to the role of average citizen after his term. The argument that returning to the mass of the people was degrading, he said, was contrary to Republican principles. In free governments, the rulers are the servants, and the people their superiors and sovereigns. For the former, therefore, to return among the latter was not to degrade, but to promote them. Likewise, he argued that Congress should have the power to impeach the president. In the past, when impeachment was not possible, the only method people had for removing a corrupt ruler was through assassination, in which he was not only deprived of his life, but of the opportunity of vindicating his character. Franklin also felt that it would be more democratic for executive power to reside with a small council, as it did in Pennsylvania, rather than one man. This was a hard debate to have with Washington sitting in the chair, as it was widely assumed that he would be the first president. So Franklin noted diplomatically that the first man to take the office would likely be benevolent. But the person who came next, perhaps he had a sense that it could be John Adams, might harbor more autocratic tendencies. On this issue, Franklin lost. But the convention did decide to institutionalize the role of the cabinet. He also advocated, unsuccessfully, the direct election of federal judges instead of permitting the president or Congress to select them. As usual, he made his argument by telling a tale. It was the practice in Scotland for judges to be nominated by that country's lawyers, who always selected the ablest of the profession in order to get rid of him and share his practice among themselves. In America, it would be in the best interest of voters to make the best choice, which was the way it should be. Many of the delegates believed strongly that only those who owned substantial property should be eligible for office, as was the case in most states other than Pennsylvania. Young Charles Pinckney of South Carolina went so far as to propose that the wealth requirement for president should be $100,000, until it was pointed out that this might exclude Washington. Franklin rose, and in Madison's words, expressed his dislike of everything that tended to debase the spirit of the common people. His democratic sensibilities were offended by any suggestion that the Constitution should betray a great partiality to the rich. On the contrary, he said, some of the greatest rogues I was ever acquainted with were the richest rogues. Likewise, he spoke out against any property requirements on the right to vote. We should not depress the virtue and public spirit of our common people. On these issues, he was successful. On only one issue did Franklin take what could be considered the less democratic position, though he did not recognize it as such. Federal officials, he argued, should serve without pay. In The Radicalism of the American Revolution, historian Gordon Wood contends that Franklin's proposal reflected the classical sentiments of aristocratic leadership, even John Adams. Generally less democratic in his outlook, wrote from London that under such a policy, all offices would be monopolized by the rich, the poor and middling ranks would be excluded, and an aristocratic despotism would immediately follow. Franklin, I think, did not intend for his proposal to be elitist or exclusionary, but instead saw it as a way to limit corrupting influences. In his many letters on the subject, he never considered, though he should have, that his plan might limit the jobs to those who could afford to work for free. Indeed, he seemed quite oblivious to this argument. Instead, he based his position on his faith in citizen volunteers and his long-standing belief that a pursuit of profit had corrupted English government. It was a case he had made in an exchange of letters with William Strawn 3 years earlier, and he used almost the exact same language on the floor of the convention. There are two passions which have a powerful influence in the affairs of men. These are ambition and avarice, the love of power and the love of money. Separately, each of these has great force in prompting men to action. But when united in view of the same object, they have in many minds the most violent effects. And of what kind are the men that will strive for this profitable preeminence through all the bustle of cabal, the heat of contention, the infinite mutual abuse of parties, tearing to pieces the best of characters? It will not be the wise and moderate, the lovers of peace and good order, the men fittest for the trust. It will be the bold and the violent, the men of strong passions and indefatigable activity in their selfish pursuits. On this issue he found almost no support, and the idea was put aside with no debate. It was treated with great respect, Madison recorded, but rather for the author of it than from any conviction of its expediency or practicability. There were, through the long and hot summer, some occasions for humor. Governor Morris of Pennsylvania, who wrote with a taut and serious pen, but at times acted as the congressional jester, was dared by Hamilton, for the price of a dinner, to slap the austere and intimidating Washington on the shoulder and say, "My dear General, how happy I am to see you look so well." Morris did, But after weathering, the look from Washington's face declared that he would not do so again for 1,000 dinners. Elbridge Gerry, arguing against a long-standing army, lasciviously compared it to a standing penis. An excellent assurance of domestic tranquility, but a dangerous temptation to foreign adventure. When it was all over, many compromises had been made, including on the issue of slavery. Some members were distressed because they felt that the final result usurped too much state sovereignty. Others because they thought it did not create a strong enough national government. The cantankerous Luther Martin of Maryland sneered contemptuously that they had concocted a perfect medley and left before the final vote. He was right, except for his contemptuous sneer. The medley was indeed as close to perfect as mortals could have achieved. From its profound first three words, "We, the people," to the carefully calibrated compromises and balances that followed, it created an ingenious system in which the power of the national government, as well as that of the states, derived directly from the citizenry. And thus it fulfilled the motto on the nation's great seal, suggested by Franklin in 1776, of E pluribus unum, out of many, one. With the wisdom of a patient chess player and the practicality of a scientist, Franklin realized that they had succeeded not because they were self-assured, but because they were willing to concede that they might be fallible. "We are making experiments in politics," he wrote La Rochefoucauld. To Dupont de Nemours, he confessed, "We must not expect that a new government may be formed as a game of chess may be played by a skillful hand without a fault." Franklin's final triumph was to express these sentiments with a wry but powerful charm in a remarkable closing address to the convention. The speech was a testament to the virtue of intellectual tolerance and to the evil of presumed infallibility. And it proclaimed for the ages the enlightened creed that became central to America's freedom. They were the most eloquent words Franklin ever wrote, and perhaps the best ever written by anyone about the magic of the American system and the spirit of compromise that created it. "I confess that I do not entirely approve this Constitution at present, but, sir, I am not sure I shall never approve it. For having lived long, I have experienced many instances of being obliged by better information or fuller consideration to change opinions, even on important subjects, which I once thought right, but found to be otherwise. It is, therefore, that the older I grow, the more apt I am to doubt my own judgment, and pay more respect to the judgment of others. Most men, indeed, as well as most sects in religion, think themselves in possession of all truth, and that wherever others differ from them, it is so far error. Steele, a Protestant in a dedication, tells the Pope that the only difference between our two churches in their opinions of the certainty of their doctrine is the Romish Church is infallible, and the Church of England is never in the wrong. But though many private persons think almost as highly of their own infallibility as of that of their sect, few express it so naturally as a certain French lady, who in a little dispute with her sister said, 'I don't know how it happens, sister, but I meet with nobody but myself that is always in the right.' In these sentiments, sir, I agree to this Constitution with all its faults, if they are such, because I think a general government necessary for us. I doubt, too, whether any other convention we can obtain may be able to make a better constitution. For when you assemble a number of men to have the advantage of their joint wisdom, you inevitably assemble with those men all their prejudices, their passions, their errors of opinion, their local interests, and their selfish views. From such an assembly, can a perfect production be expected? It therefore astonishes me, sir, to find this system approaching so near to perfection as it does. And I think it will astonish our enemies, who are waiting with confidence to hear that our counsels are confounded like those of the builders of Babel, and that our states are on the point of separation, only to meet hereafter for the purpose of cutting one another's throats. Thus, I consent, sir, to this constitution, because I expect no better, and because I am not sure that it is not the best." He concluded by pleading that, for the sake of our posterity, we shall act heartily and unanimously. To that end, he made a motion that the convention adopt the device of declaring that the document had been accepted by all of the states, which would allow even the minority of delegates who dissented to sign it. "I cannot help expressing a wish that every member of the convention who may still have objections to it would, with me, on this occasion, doubt a little of his own infallibility, and to make manifest our unanimity, put his name to this instrument." And so it was that when Franklin finished, most of the delegates, even some with doubts, heeded his urgings and lined up by state delegation for the historic signing. As they did so, Franklin turned their attention to the sun carved on the back of Washington's chair and observed that painters often found it difficult to distinguish in their art a rising sun from a setting one. "I have," he said, "often in the course of the session and the vicissitudes of my hopes and fears as to its issue, looked at that behind the president without being able to tell whether it was rising or setting. But now at length I have the happiness to know that it is a rising and not a setting sun." According to a tale recorded by James McHenry of Maryland, he made his point in a pithier way to an anxious lady named Mrs. Powell, who accosted him outside the hall. "What type of government," she asked, "have you delegates given us?" To which he replied, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it." The historian Clinton Rossiter has called Franklin's closing speech the most remarkable performance of a remarkable life. And the Yale scholar Barbara Oberg calls it the culmination of Franklin's life as a propagandist, persuader, and cajoler of people. With his deft and self-deprecating use of double negatives, "I am not sure I shall never approve it. I am not sure that it is not the best." He emphasized the humility and appreciation for human fallibility that was necessary to form a nation. Opponents attacked Franklin's compromising approach as lacking in principle, yet that was the point of his message. "A stand for compromise," Oberg points out, "is not the stuff of heroism, virtue, or moral certainty, but it is the essence of the democratic process." Throughout his life, Franklin had, by his thoughts and activities, helped to lay the foundation for the democratic republic that this Constitution enshrined. He had begun as a young man by teaching his fellow tradesmen ways to become virtuous, diligent, and responsible citizens. Then he sought to enlist them in associations, juntos, libraries, fire departments, neighborhood patrols, and militias, for their mutual benefit and the good of the common community. Later, he created networks, from the Postal Service to the American Philosophical Society, designed to foster the connections that would integrate an emerging nation. Finally, in the 1750s, he began pushing the colonies to gain strength through unity, to stand together for common purposes in a way that helped shape a national identity. Since that time, he had been instrumental in shaping every major document that led to the creation of the new republic. He was the only person to sign all four of its founding papers: the Declaration of Independence, the Treaty with France, the Peace Accord with Britain, and the Constitution. In addition, he devised the first federal scheme for America, the unfulfilled Albany Plan of 1754, under which the separate states and a national government would have shared power. And the Articles of Confederation he proposed in 1775 were a closer approximation of the final Constitution than were the weak and ill-fated alternative articles adopted in 1781. The Constitution, wrote Henry May in his book The Enlightenment in America, reflected all the virtues of the moderate Enlightenment and also one of its faults, the belief that everything can be settled by compromise. For Franklin, who embodied the Enlightenment and its spirit of compromise, this was hardly a fault. For him, compromise was not only a practical approach, but a moral one. Tolerance, humility, and a respect for others required it. On almost every issue for more than two centuries, this supposed fault has served the Constitution and the nation it formed quite well. There was only one great issue that could not then or later be solved by constitutional compromise: slavery. And that indeed was the issue on which Franklin, as his life neared its end, chose to take an uncompromising stand. End game. Franklin's role in the miracle at Philadelphia could have been a fitting finale to a career spent creating the possibility of a free and democratic republic. And for most people, or at least most people of his era approaching 82, it would have been enough to sate any ambition. Now he could, if he wanted, retire from public life, knowing that he was widely revered and had outlasted any enemies. Nevertheless, a month after personally presenting a copy of the new federal constitution to the Pennsylvania Assembly, he accepted re-election for a third one-year term as the state's president. "It was my intention to decline serving another year as president, that I might be at liberty to take a trip to Boston in the spring," he wrote his sister. "I have now upwards of 50 years employed in public offices." He would, in fact, never travel nor see his sister again. His kidney stones and her health, he noted, made it so they would have to be satisfied by letters rather than visits. In addition, as he freely admitted, his pride made him still appreciate public recognition. "It is no small pleasure to me, and I suppose it will give my sister pleasure, that after such a long trial of me, I should be elected a third time by my fellow citizens," he wrote. "This universal and unbounded confidence of a whole people flatters my vanity much more than a peerage could do." Franklin's letters to his sister were filled with such candid comments, especially during his later years. At one point he scolded that, "Your post office is very badly managed," and decried her propensity to get into little feuds. This led to an amusing riff on how the Franklins were always subject to being a little miffy. What had happened, he asked, to the Folger cousins in Nantucket? They are wonderfully shy, but I admire their honest plainness of speech. About a year ago, I invited two of them to dine with me. Their answer was that they would if they could not do better. I suppose they did better, for I never saw them afterwards. To Noah Webster, the famous lexicographer who had dedicated his Dissertations on the English Language to him, Franklin lamented the loose new word usages infecting the language. A common complaint of curmudgeonly writers, but a bit atypical of the jovial Franklin, who had once taken pleasure in inventing new English words, and with even more pleasure, amusing the ladies of Paris with new French ones. I find a verb formed from the substantive notice, I should not have noticed this were it not for that gentleman, etc. Also another verb from the substantive advocate, the gentleman who advocates or who has advocated that motion, etc. Another from the substantive progress, the most awkward and abominable of the three. The committee, having progressed, resolved to adjourn. If you should happen to be of my opinion with respect to these innovations, you will use your authority in reprobating them. He also finally resumed work on his autobiography. He had written 87 manuscript pages in Twyford in 1771, and then added 12 more in Passy in 1784. Writing steadily from August 1788 until May of the following year, he completed another 119 pages, which brought him up to his arrival in England as a colonial agent. I omit all facts and transactions that may not have a tendency to benefit the young reader, he wrote to Vaughan. His purpose was still to provide a self-help manual for America's ambitious middle class by describing my success in emerging from poverty and the advantages of certain modes of conduct which I observed. By now he was facing ever greater pain from his kidney stones, and he resorted to using laudanum, a tincture of opium and alcohol. I am so interrupted by extreme pain, which obliges me to have recourse to opium, that between the effects of both I have but little time in which I can write anything, he complained to Vaughan. He also worried that what he had written was not worth publishing. Give me your candid opinion whether I had best publish it or suppress it, he asked, for I am grown so old and feeble in mind as well as body that I cannot place any confidence in my own judgment. He had now begun to dictate the work to Benny rather than write it by hand, but he was able to complete only a few more pages. Friends sent him various home remedies for kidney stones, including a suggestion from Vaughan, which amused Franklin, that a small dose of hemlock might work. At times he could be cheerful enough about his maladies and repeat his maxim, that those who drink to the bottom of the cup must expect to meet some of the dregs, as he did to his old friend Elizabeth Partridge. He was still, he said, joking, laughing, and telling merry stories as when you first knew me, a young man about 50. Yet Franklin was becoming resigned to the fact that he did not have much longer to live, and his letters took on a tone of sanguine farewell. Hitherto this long life has been tolerably happy, he wrote to Katie Ray Green, the girl who had captured his mind and heart 35 years earlier. If I were allowed to live it over again, I should make no objection, only wishing for leave to do what authors do in a second edition of their works, correct some of my errata. When Washington became president that year, Franklin wrote to him that it made him glad he was still alive. "For my own personal ease, I should have died 2 years ago. But though those years have been spent in excruciating pain, I am pleased that I have lived them, since they have brought me to see our present situation." He was also sanguine about the revolution now welling up in his beloved France. The explosion of democratic sentiments was producing mischief and trouble, he noted, but he assumed that it would lead to greater democracy and eventually a good constitution. So most of his letters to his French friends were inappropriately lighthearted. "Are you still living?" he wrote the French scientist Jean-Baptiste Leroy, his friend and Passy neighbor, in late 1789. "Or have the mob of Paris mistaken the head of a monopolizer of knowledge for a monopolizer of corn and paraded it about the streets upon a pole?" It was also in this letter that he famously noted that nothing can be said to be certain except death and taxes. He assured Louis-Guillaume Leveillard, his neighbor and closest friend in Passy, that it was all for the good. "When the fermentation is over and the troubling parts subsided, the wine will be fine and good, and cheer the hearts of those that drink it." Franklin was wrong, sadly wrong, about the French Revolution, though he would not live long enough to learn it. Leveillard would soon lose his life to the guillotine. So would Lavoisier, the chemist, who had worked with him on the Mesmer investigation. Condorcet, the economist who had accompanied Franklin to his famed meetings with Voltaire, would be imprisoned and poison himself in his cell. And La Rochefoucauld, who had translated the state constitutions for Franklin and engaged him in a lively correspondence since his departure, would be stoned to death by a mob. Slavery. In the very last year of his life, Franklin was to embark on one final public mission, a moral crusade that would help ameliorate one of the few blemishes on a life spent fighting for freedom. Throughout much of the 18th century, slavery had been an institution that few whites questioned. Even in brotherly Philadelphia, ownership continued to climb until about 1760, when almost 10% of the city's population were slaves. But views had begun to evolve, especially after the ringing words of the Declaration and the awkward compromises of the Constitution. George Mason of Virginia, despite the fact that he owned 200 slaves, called the institution pernicious at the Constitutional Convention, and declared that every master of slaves is a petty tyrant. They bring the judgment of heaven on a country. Franklin's views had been evolving as well. He had, as we have seen, owned one or two household slaves off and on for much of his life, and as a young publisher, he had carried ads for slave sales. But he had also published in 1729 one of the nation's first anti-slavery pieces and had joined the Associates of Dr. Bray to establish schools for blacks in America. Deborah had enrolled her house servants in the Philadelphia school, and after visiting it, Franklin had spoken of his higher opinions of the natural capacities of the black race. In his 1751 Observations on the Increase of Mankind, he attacked slavery strongly, but mainly from an economic perspective rather than a moral one. In expressing sympathy for the Philadelphia abolitionist Anthony Benezet in the 1770s, he had agreed that the importation of new slaves should end immediately. But he qualified his support for outright abolition by saying it should come in time. As an agent for Georgia in London, He had defended the right of that colony to keep slaves. But he preached in articles such as his 1772 The Somerset Case and the Slave Trade that one of Britain's great sins against America was foisting slavery on it. Franklin's conversion culminated in 1787, when he accepted the presidency of the Pennsylvania Society for Promoting the Abolition of Slavery. The group tried to persuade him to present a petition against slavery at the Constitutional Convention. But knowing the delicate compromises being made between North and South, he kept silent on the issue. After that, however, he became outspoken. One of the arguments against immediate abolition, which Franklin had heretofore accepted, was that it was not practical or safe to free hundreds of thousands of adult slaves into a society for which they were not prepared. There were about 700,000 slaves in the United States out of a total population of 4 million in 1790. So his abolition society dedicated itself not only to freeing slaves, but also to helping them become good citizens. "Slavery is such an atrocious debasement of human nature that its very extirpation, if not performed with solicitous care, may sometimes open a source of serious evils," Franklin wrote in a November 1789 address to the public from the society. "The unhappy man who has long been treated as a brute animal too frequently sinks beneath the common standard of the human species. The galling chains that bind his body do also fetter his intellectual faculties and impair the social affections of his heart." As was typical of Franklin, he drew up for the society a meticulously detailed charter and procedures for improving the condition of free blacks. There would be a 24-person committee divided into 4 subcommittees. 1. A committee of inspection who shall superintend the morals, general conduct, and ordinary situation of the free Negroes and afford them advice and instruction. 2. A committee of guardians who shall place out children and young people with suitable persons that they may, during a moderate time of apprenticeship or servitude, learn some trade or other business. 3. A committee of education, who shall superintend the school instruction of the children and youth of the free blacks. They may either influence them to attend regularly the schools already established in this city, or form others with this view. 4. A committee of employ, who shall endeavor to procure constant employment for those free Negroes who are able to work, as the want of this would occasion poverty, idleness, and many vicious habits. On behalf of the society, Franklin presented a formal abolition petition to Congress in February 1790. "Mankind are all formed by the same Almighty Being, alike objects of his care, and equally designed for the enjoyment of happiness," it declared. The duty of Congress was to secure the blessings of liberty to the people of the United States, and this should be done without distinction of color. Therefore, Congress should grant liberty to those unhappy men who alone in this land of freedom are degraded into perpetual bondage. Franklin and his petition were roundly denounced by the defenders of slavery, most notably Congressman James Jackson of Georgia, who declared on the House floor that the Bible had sanctioned slavery, and without it there would be no one to do the hard and hot work on plantations. It was the perfect setup for Franklin's last great parody, written less than a month before he died. He had begun his literary career 68 years earlier, when, as a 16-year-old apprentice, he pretended to be a prudish widow named Silence Dugood. And he made a subsequent career of enlightening readers with similar hoaxes, such as The Trial of Polly Baker and An Edict from the King of Prussia. In the spirit of the latter of these essays, he anonymously published in a local newspaper, with appropriate scholarly source citations, a purported speech given by a member of the Divan of Algiers 100 years earlier. It bore a scathing mirror resemblance to Congressman Jackson's speech. "God is great, and Muhammad is his prophet," it began realistically. Then it went on to attack a petition by a purist sect asking for an end to the practice of capturing and enslaving European Christians to work in Algeria. "If we forbear to make slaves of their people, who in this hot climate are to cultivate our lands? Who are to perform the common labors of our city and in our families?" An end to the slavery of infidels would cause land values to fall and rents to sink by half. "Who is to indemnify their masters for their loss? Will the state do it? Is our treasury sufficient? And if we set our slaves free, what is to be done with them? Few of them will return to their countries. They know too well the greater hardships they must there be subject to. They will not embrace our holy religion. They will not adopt our manners. Our people will not pollute themselves by intermarrying with them. Must we maintain them as beggars in our streets, or suffer our properties to be the prey of their pillage? For men long accustomed to slavery will not work for a livelihood when not compelled. And what is there so pitiable in their present condition? Here they are brought into a land where the sun of Islamism gives forth its light and shines in full splendor, and they have an opportunity of making themselves acquainted with the true doctrine and thereby saving their immortal souls. While serving us, we take care to provide them with everything, and they are treated with humanity. The laborers in their own country are, as I am well informed, worse fed, lodged, and clothed. How grossly are they mistaken in imagining slavery to be disallowed by the Koran? Are not the two precepts, to quote no more, 'Masters, treat your slaves with kindness. Slaves, serve your masters with cheerfulness and fidelity,' clear proofs to the contrary? Let us then hear no more of this detestable proposition, the manumission of Christian slaves, the adoption of which would, by depreciating our lands and houses and thereby depriving so many good citizens of their properties, create universal discontent and provoke insurrections." In his parody, Franklin recorded that the Algerian divan ended up rejecting the petition. Congress, likewise, decided that it did not have the authority to act on Franklin's abolition petition. To bed. It is not surprising that at the end of their lives, many people take stock of their religious beliefs. Franklin had never fully joined a church nor subscribed to a sectarian dogma, and he found it more useful to focus on earthly issues rather than spiritual ones. When he narrowly escaped a shipwreck as he neared the English coast in 1757, he had joked to Deborah that, "Were I a Roman Catholic, perhaps I should on this occasion vow to build a chapel to some saint, but as I am not, if I were to vow at all, it should be to build a lighthouse." Likewise, when a town in Massachusetts named itself Franklin in 1785 and asked him to donate a church bell, he told them to forsake the steeple and build a library, for which he sent books instead of a bell, sense being preferable to sound. As he grew older, Franklin's amorphous faith in a benevolent God seemed to become more firm. If it had not been for the justice of our cause and the consequent interposition of Providence in which we had faith, we must have been ruined, he wrote Strawn after the war. If I had ever before been an atheist, I should now have been convinced of the being and government of a deity. His support for religion tended to be based on his belief that it was useful and practical in making people behave better, rather than because it was divinely inspired. He wrote a letter, possibly sent in 1786 to Thomas Paine, in response to a manuscript that ridiculed religious devotion. Franklin begged the recipient not to publish his heretical treatise, but he did so on the grounds that the arguments could have harmful practical effects, not on the grounds that they were false. You yourself may find it easy to live a virtuous life without the assistance afforded by religion, he said. But think how great a proportion of mankind consists of weak and ignorant men and women, and of inexperienced and inconsiderate youth of both sexes, who have need of the motives of religion to restrain them from vice. In addition, he noted, the personal consequences for the author would likely be odious. He that spits against the wind spits in his own face. If the letter was indeed addressed to Paine, it had an effect. He had long been formulating the virulent attack on organized religious faith that he would later title The Age of Reason. But he held off publishing it for another 7 years, until near the end of his life. The most important religious role Franklin played, and it was an exceedingly important one in shaping his enlightened new republic, was as an apostle of tolerance. He had contributed to the building funds of each and every sect in Philadelphia, including £5 for the congregation Mikveh Israel for its new synagogue in April 1788, and he had opposed religious oaths and tests in both the Pennsylvania and federal constitutions. During the July 4th celebrations in 1788, Franklin was too sick to leave his bed, but the parade marched under his window. For the first time, as per arrangements that Franklin had overseen, the clergy of different Christian denominations, with the rabbi of the Jews, walked arm in arm. His final summation of his religious thinking came the month before he died. In response to questions from the Reverend Ezra Stiles, president of Yale, Franklin began by restating his basic creed. I believe in one God, creator of the universe, that he governs it by his providence, that he ought to be worshipped, that the most acceptable service we render to him is doing good to his other children. These beliefs were fundamental to all religions. Anything else was mere embellishment. Then he addressed Stiles's question about whether he believed in Jesus, which was, he said, the first time he had ever been asked directly. The system of morals that Jesus provided, Franklin replied, was the best the world ever saw or is likely to see. But on the issue of whether Jesus was divine, he provided a surprisingly candid and wry response. I have, he declared, some doubts as to his divinity, though it is a question I do not dogmatize upon, having never studied it, and think it needless to busy myself with it now when I expect soon an opportunity of knowing the truth with less trouble. The last letter Franklin ever wrote was, fittingly, to Thomas Jefferson, his spiritual heir as the nation's foremost apostle of the Enlightenment's faith in reason, experiment, and tolerance. Jefferson had come to call at Franklin's bedside and provide news of their beleaguered friends in France. He went over all in succession, Jefferson noted, with a rapidity and animation almost too much for his strength. Jefferson praised him for getting so far in his memoirs, which he predicted would be very instructive. "I cannot say much of that," replied Franklin, "but I will give you a sample." Then he pulled out a page that described the last weeks of his negotiations in London to avert the war, which he insisted that Jefferson keep as a memento. Jefferson followed up by asking about an arcane issue that needed resolving. Which maps had been used to draw America's western boundaries in the Paris peace talks? After Jefferson left, Franklin studied the matter and then wrote his final letter. His mind was clear enough to describe with precision the decisions they had made and the maps they had used regarding various rivers running into the Bay of Passamaquoddy. Soon after he finished the letter, Franklin's fever and chest pains began to worsen. For 10 days he was confined to bed with a heavy cough and labored breathing. Sally and Richard Bache attended to him, as did Temple and Benny. Polly Stevenson was there as well, pressing him to make a clearer proclamation of his religious faith, pleased that he had a picture of the Day of Judgment by his bedside. Only once during that period was he able to rise briefly, and he asked that his bed be made up so that he could die in a decent manner. Sally expressed hope that he was recovering, that he might live many years longer. "I hope not," he calmly replied. Then an abscess in his lung burst, making it impossible for him to talk. Benny approached his bed, and his grandfather reached out to hold his hand for a long time. At 11 that evening, April 17, 1790, Franklin died at the age of 84. Back in 1728, when he was a fledgling printer imbued with the pride that he believed an honest man should have in his trade, Franklin had composed for himself, or at least for his amusement, a cheeky epitaph that reflected his wry perspective on his pilgrim's progress through this world. "The body of B. Franklin, printer, like the cover of an old book, its contents worn out and stripped of its lettering and gilding, lies here food for worms. But the work shall not be lost. For it will, as he believed, appear once more in a new and more elegant edition, revised and corrected by the author." Shortly before he died, however, he prescribed something simpler to be placed over the gravesite that he would share with his wife. His tombstone should be, he wrote, a marble slab, 6 feet long, 4 feet wide, plain, with only a small molding round the upper edge, and this inscription: "Benjamin and Deborah Franklin." Close to 20,000 mourners, more than had ever before gathered in Philadelphia, watched as his funeral procession made its way to the Christchurch burying ground, a few blocks from his home. In front marched the clergymen of the city, all of them, of every faith. Chapter 17. Epilogue. William Franklin. In his will, Franklin bequeathed to his only surviving son nothing more than some worthless land claims in Canada and the forgiveness of any debts he still owed him. The part he acted against me in the late war, which is of public notoriety, will account for my leaving him no more of an estate he endeavored to deprive me of. William, who thought he had already paid off his debts by deeding over his New Jersey lands, complained about the shameful injustice of the will, and for the remaining 25 years of his life never returned to America. But he still revered his father's memory, and he did not permit himself another harsh public word about him. Indeed, when his own son, Temple, dithered in producing an edition of Franklin's life and writings, William began work on one of his own, which he hoped would honor his father by showing the turn of his mind and variety of his knowledge. It was not to be. He had married his Irish landlady, Mary Devlin, but after she died in 1811 he was a broken and lonely man. He died 3 years later, estranged from his son, suffering in what he called that solitary state which is most repugnant to my nature. Temple Franklin. Having inherited a nice share of his grandfather's estate and all of his important papers, Temple returned to England in 1792 and reunited temporarily with his father. Still a charming but aimless rogue, he chafed under his father's pressure to get married and work on Franklin's papers, and he brought the family's dysfunctionality to new heights. He had another illegitimate child, a daughter named Ellen, whose mother was the younger sister of William's new wife. And then he broke bitterly with them all and ran away to Paris, leaving little Ellen Franklin to be raised by William, who was both her uncle and grandfather. For 14 years, Temple neither reestablished contact with his father nor published the papers of his grandfather, even as unauthorized portions of the autobiography appeared.